Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's November 8th, 2023. I'm your host, Eric Ostman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 10 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your startup launch better products faster, free up your bandwidth for innovation, and nail your value delivery every time. And if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll chart a roadmap for success free. Worst case, you get a clear roadmap for shoring up your infrastructure. Best case, we co-build it with you and empower your DevOps team in 90 days or less. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live. Don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/office hours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's office hours session valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse, or maybe send us a short testimonial about the value you're getting in our Slack team. Just go to slack.cloudposse.com. Remember, we're not just simply creating content here. We're building a vibrant DevOps community, and we can't do that without you. So with that said, let's jump into the announcements. First one is, anybody who is a regular in AWS, you're familiar with the AWS well-architected framework. Apparently, Amazon has published some significant updates to that framework, doing a better job organizing the content there to make it more manageable. I haven't had a chance to go into it myself yet to call out any highlights, but just be aware. The next announcement I was really excited about, and I was surprised to be so excited about it and kind of surprised that, I don't know, we hadn't done something similar about it before. First of all, what it is. So TF Provider Check, it's by Suzuki. He is a prolific open source developer. He has tons of utilities largely focused around Terraform. We use his Terraform formatting command line tool. This is really good if you're using Terraform in a CI/CD context. This will help you generate really clean markdown presentations and TF action. I guess that's his own collection of actions, things there. But there's a lot more here. I don't know. He hasn't pinned them, but let's get back to it. TF Provider Check, why should you care? One of the biggest dirty little secrets about Terraform that anybody who questions it long enough will kind of arrive at this conclusion is, it's really easy to exfiltrate anything you want from Terraform. And if you're running Terraform in a CI/CD context, doesn't matter if you're like only, you're only doing plans as part of your CI/CD workflow there. If somebody can open a PR in your, private infrastructure repo where you're doing all of this and change some Terraform code, and that Terraform code decides to call a provider of its choosing, then game over. Because you can do anything you want inside of a provider, full, capability of the Go language. So how do you prevent that? Well, there's no silver bullet for it, but one way is, and this is one of these things, you could engineer a very complicated solution for this and spend 80% more time and effort for a 20% marginal improvement, or you could just take this simple approach of TF provider check. So TF provider check lets you restrict or basically provide an allow list of trusted providers and versions. And you leverage this now in your pipelines. So ideally, you'll call this before you do any Terraform plans or work. And the key thing here is you, if you do this in GitHub Actions, you have to use a pull request target. So it executes based on the configuration in the main branch, not the configuration of your branch, because otherwise I'll just add my exfiltration provider and allow listed at the same time in my pull request. You don't want that. So you need this check to run separate here. And here's an example then of how to do that. So how you would go about this is create an overall allow list of providers at your company that you bless, and then, you know, have a vetting process. Put your provider check file in your code owners so nobody can change it willy-nilly without a code owner approval. And now you can rest a little bit more assured that one more attack vector for exfiltration isn't there, and that sneaky providers don't somehow make their way into your code. Anyone have something to add to that?
I don't know that I have a fully working solution in my head, but I just started thinking about this. But I think you could probably achieve something similar using the Terraform config, like the CLI config. Like if you set the installation directory to local for everything except for the two or three providers that you use, which you say direct, and then say local for everything else, like it wouldn't actually be able to find those nefarious providers out there anywhere.
That's an interesting approach as well. I see what you're saying. So what you're talking about is exploiting more or less a hack in the Terraform CLI config that's used by Terraform provider developers so that they can easily use their local provider without pulling it from upstream, right, Matt?
Yeah, but it's actually not just for Terraform provider, like developers. It's actually for people who have their own internal Terraform registries or proxies that they have to go through or any of that kind of thing. It configures the network client in Terraform to tell it how to resolve certain providers and where to resolve them from.
Does it work on a separate range as well, or this would just be more at the provider name level?
It's you can use like glob patterns to match like providers and versions and that kind of thing. In the URL, basically, you do matching. The other thing I was going to say is use Terraform lock files, because that actually locks in what providers you can use if you're strict on your lock file and don't allow your lock file to be updated.
Yeah, so I think that the lock file approach is good as well. And you can also commit the lock file and put the lock file under code owners. What I still like about this utility, and I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive, it's having layers of defense and enabling perhaps teams to be a little bit more autonomous. So at a corporate level, you can have trusted providers. Look, we trust any version of the AWS provider greater than 3.0. When you want to upgrade, that's up to you. And then you can have this enforced at an organizational level, while you can have the lock file be, you know, the lock file will then be secondary to this, because this would run before any Terraform lock checks. And then there's also organizational actions. I've for organization-wide actions. Yeah. So they announced at the beginning of this year these organization-wide actions, which is pretty cool, because then if you wanted to implement this, you could actually enforce only trusted providers at a whole organization level. And I like the sound of that. All right. Any questions or alternatives? Like somebody else was suggesting, couldn't this just be done with like TF-Lint or TF-Sec or something? I suppose something like that could be used. Or a conf test. All right. Next announcement is Grafana is introducing a Kubernetes cost management capabilities into their cloud offering. That's interesting. This was where KubeCost got its origin. I'm not okay. And is open, anyone know if there is any relationship between OpenCost and KubeCost, if any? I forget what the story is there. Aha, OpenCost was originally developed and open sourced by KubeCost. So yeah, that's the relationship there. So that's interesting. So why this is cool is, you know, you might have your cost management dashboards all set up, and that gives you good visibility overall into like what you're spending maybe on AWS, but the larger and larger your platform grows, your Kubernetes cluster grows, how do you actually break down that significant cost of your Kubernetes cluster itself? And then you can use cost management tooling like this to approximate what your services are costing inside of Kubernetes itself. And if you're running like a SaaS platform, this is really nice then to understand maybe what individual services are contributing to the cost of servicing your customer. All right. Next one here is OpenTofu has announced a, I don't know what the right term is, but a concurrent event with KubeCon and Cloud Native Con Europe happening in March. So they're going to have some talks hosted then on Wednesday. Or no, that's when they submit it. All right, March 19th. If you are using Global Accelerator, it's one of the things that we provision in some of our reference architecture implementations. One of the nice things is now that accelerator can have endpoints across accounts. This is useful, for example, if you have your main vanity domain, your main branded DNS pointed to this Global Accelerator, but you want to be able to have parts of your product hosted in different AWS accounts. Terraform, this was actually announced back in October, but I didn't see it. There's a preview, a tech preview for automatically generating Terraform providers from any open API specification. This can greatly increase, obviously, the number of providers available and the bar for companies to support Terraform in their offering, provided that they're able to expose an open API specification for their backend. Also reducing the overhead of maintaining that provider, which is the other battle you'll see a lot of providers out there become stale and not receive the latest updates as a result of having to maintain another client library.
That's pretty cool. The providers are supposed to be continue to be like Mozilla or like open source to where we should be using with OpenTofu if we end up making that switch, right?
Yeah. That should make it a lot easier. Like, for example, if there happen to be changes introduced to providers in the HashiCorp Terraform that are incompatible, for example, with OpenTofu, if more services adopt an open API specification, then providers should be able to be generated for either platform. Right now, though, providers are compatible with both. All right. Next, next announcement here is, yeah, just a minor one. Personally, I've been really happy using 1Password and its ability to manage SSH keys. I don't believe it's using OS X enclaves to do that. If you are looking to do that, though, here's a utility implemented that helps you store your SSH keys in the secure enclave within the Mac. All right, that's all the announcements I had. Let me check the Zoom chat and see what's going on there. Oh, thanks, Vlad, for sharing some updates here. So AWS App Runner now supports inbound IPv6. Oh, yeah, inbound, yep. And CloudWatch Container Insights launches enhanced observability for EKS.
Anything? I did not dive into this at all.
Mm-hmm.
No idea, just saw it. It might be relevant. My brain is also a bit mush with pre-invent stuff.
All right. Next, I wasn't able to summarize that one quickly. AWS Lambda supports faster polling scale-up rate for SQS as an event source.
Yeah, I don't have my notes because I'm from a different computer, but Lambda and SQS are now like, yeah, 5 times faster, which is quite a big deal for everybody that was doing putting events into an SQS queue and using Lambda to hold events. Also, if you didn't have an upper limit set, surprise, you really should set upper limit on stuff.
Yeah, and let's see here. Next announcement was Code Build Compute. What is this? AWS Code Build now supports AWS Lambda Compute.
Yeah, this is super exciting. So I don't know how many people here are familiar with, what was it called, Lambda CI? It was basically a CI thing that was running by triggering, I don't know how many hundreds of Lambda to have super, super fast builds.
Mm-hmm.
But Code Build now natively supports Lambda as runners. It's very limited because it's still Lambda. Like, you cannot do Docker builds. You cannot do a bunch of stuff, 15-minute runtime, la-di-da-di-da. And as I remember, there is also very limited caching or something like that. But I haven't had time to dive deep into the performance characteristics of it, but it's very, very, very exciting for me. And I cannot wait to take it for a proper spin. I care deeply about how long CI takes. So if this might be an opportunity to automate stuff like linting, I would be very excited. But I'm curious to see how long the repository download will take. That's my main concern.
That's true. That could reduce some of the excitement around it. And
lots of them might not have enough space. to download repositories for big repositories.
Yeah. Does Lambda offer any, well, no, this would be custom, so there would be no way for it to start from some shared cache?
I don't know. I imagine you could maybe potentially set some layers.
Lambda supports EFS now.
So. Yeah, and you could also have a layer that has your cache built into it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this is exciting if you are heavy on AWS's CI tooling, code build, code pipeline, and so forth. I'd be really excited to see somebody implement this for action runners, GitHub Actions, to run that way. Quick Googling saw a abandoned project 3 years ago attempting something like that. Clearly didn't see the light of day, really.
Yeah, also there were 15-minute performance issues and the basically killing the GitHub API with things. Since then, they improved with ephemeral runners and a bunch of other things. But yeah, but I'm only using code build in a very few specific cases, specifically when I need a really chunky server for intense builds or testing. Because code build has, they have a server size that's 200 something gigs of RAM or something like that. Or whenever I need something that needs to connect to fancy stuff inside AWS. And I'm still calling it with they have an AWS action, GitHub action that basically triggers a build in code build. But yeah, the Lambda stuff is really, really exciting because it might be able to speed up some CI stuff.
Yeah. All right. And then let's see. Two more announcements. Or that was the last one you had. Then Matt.
Yeah, they're from Matt.
Yeah. EC2 instance metadata service now V2 by default. I thought that had already happened, but so if your apps now mysteriously start breaking and they were just working.
This isn't until March, though, I think, or something, or mid-2024. There you go.
Oh, okay. That'll be the default. Okay.
And for new EC2 instances.
Okay.
Yeah. But there are a bunch of applications that, third-party applications in particular, that run like in some commercial ones we've seen that will not properly work with V2. So I forget, I think it was like Teleport or something that still relies on IDMS V1, which is kind of like, which is a little ironic given what Teleport's like whole mission in life is to make secure access, but they might have fixed it.
I think they fixed that, but we raised that issue to them and made a strong argument for that.
But there are others that I've come across as well that have problems with it.
It sounds like to be safe, if we're running Kubernetes and multiple node pools, to basically create a new node pool and test that things still work, especially if we're using Teleport or other, I guess, operators from the sounds of it.
Mm-hmm.
Although Kubernetes is probably not going to be affected that much because the pods can't call the instance metadata service that crosses the boundary. Like you have to call it only from the host operating system. So it's only things that run directly like on the host that call the metadata service usually.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's only available on a loopback address. I just wanted to say it's like a special, it's a special address, like only on the host itself. So sorry, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing you point out. I remember in COPS, it was implemented literally just as an IP table rule that would prevent it. I'm curious how it's implemented in EKS.
They leave it up to the underlying instance, basically, to make sure that doesn't happen. But I've previously written IP tables rules that only allow root users to call the IDMS service as well, which is probably good practice to roll out on in general. But anyway, we could talk about that later.
Remind me what Finch is. I don't remember this.
It's a CLI tool to build and do a bunch of things with Linux containers on Mac, basically.
Oh, by AWS?
Yeah.
It's basically an alternative to Docker Desktop.
This was
or to response. Rancher or to what it called, OrbStack.
And this was in response to the licensing changes to Docker, then they came out with this, or?
Yeah, I think so.
Basically customers yelled at AWS that, well, I think it uses, it uses Lima NerdCTL container, the build kit. And people yelled at AWS that, oh my God, no. And AWS was like, fine, we're going to build Finch. And they built Finch, which is fine. Like, it does make it a heck of a lot easier, but it doesn't get close to Docker Desktop. And you wouldn't expect it to. But it's a valid alternative for some people, I imagine.
All right.
Yeah. And I think this was the announcement that it went GA. I think that's, it was beta before.
All right. Let's see. Next, what do I have here? I think that was it then for announcements. Anyone have something else we're missing to bring up today? All right, next is Q&A. All right, any questions that we can get answered on the call today?
Hi.
Hey there.
I have a quick question, just maybe a little bit of context. So our organization is using CDK, CloudFormation, not our DevOps team choice, by the way. This was kind of handed down to us. And so we're using the CDK project to synthesize templates that we are going to hand off to a customer. The customer will run those templates in whatever desired AWS account with existing VPCs and subnets and whatnot. And we'll deploy EKS that's Fargate enabled. We'll share artifacts with them, artifacts just meaning Docker images that we've already built and deploy it in their environment. So one of the things that came up out of this was the certificate process. How we want to deal with certificates. And I had a few assumptions and I don't think they're correct. And so I'm just trying to open up this question, maybe get some suggestions. There was kind of two pathways we were looking at right now without any confirmation from the customer. One, they might provide a certificate in their environment, that they get from DigiCert or something. And they store somewhere. The other pathway is, we recommend the customer generate an AWS certificate. That way the renewal process is, kind of hands off with the other benefits of it. And the assumption I'm making here is that something like Cert Manager would be able to deal with this, generate the other certificates required to distribute to the services we're going to deploy. So forgive me, I might be making a few assumptions here. I'm just trying to look for some suggestions on how we can deal with this. And to your, I think Eric, you made a point a few meetings ago, using self-signed certs works for our testing environment, but it's a liability. It's kind of a hard problem because we've never dealt with an external customer. Mostly our work revolves around internal customers, right? Which are just developers. Yeah. So I'll stop there.
I mean, I'm smirking because I've gone through exactly this same challenge with another customer with kind of like an enterprise-y SaaS option where you could also self-host that SaaS product. And it, you know, what seemed like such a simple solution ended up becoming so enormously complex. And this was exactly one of those issues that we had to solve. So first of all, you make a, when you make one of these self-hosted offerings, like shrink-wrapped products kind of that they can install on in their own environment, it is so hard to anticipate all of the hoops that you may need to encounter. And if you are selling this to enterprise customers and enterprise environments, oh my God, like all the assumptions you have, even on a VPC, maybe DNS is turned off on VPC. So if you're expecting host names to be generated automatically, that's not going to work. Maybe they don't even have internet egress there and you have to go through a transit gateway, and that could be Route 53 firewall. And it's like, don't even assume get networking to work. And then they're going to, are you provisioning the VPC or are they giving you a VPC?
So they are going to provide the account, the VPC, the subnets, any sort of configurations, any VPC service endpoints, because this is going to be an EKS cluster that's fully private. So there's no egress required. And the problem is, like you're pointing out with the enterprise customer, you know, we might give them a prescriptive guideline on exactly what needs to be there for us to be able to deploy this correctly, but they're going to have other compliance and security reasons for adding all sorts of different stuff on top of it that we just, we're not privy to at all. And they pretty much
you're using Bottle Rocket, even though Bottle Rocket is a lot more secure. No, we only support Red Hat, you know, whatever, in 2 years, you know, end of life or something. Okay, to answer your question on DNS, this is a really interesting one because it seems like it should have been the easiest part of the whole thing that you're trying to do. And if you think about like Redis, and if you think about RDS, and you think about Elasticsearch, and you think about every service AWS offers other than load balancers, they provide built-in TLS. But if you want to use an ALB, the only way to do TLS is with, you know, you can bring your own cert and host it on ACM, or you can have ACM generated. If you have an ACM generated, how are you going to validate it? Your email is one option and DNS validation is the other. And there's the crux of the problem. So now you have a DNS problem, and DNS is highly regulated in enterprise environments. And how are they going to get DNS to this cluster and to this account and associated with the load balancer such that you can generate that certificate? And that is a pain in the ass. So you mentioned Cert Manager. And one of the things we were hoping when, with this solution was, oh, this is no big deal. We're just going to, by default, be compatible with the Amazon public host name or, you know, or private host name, whatever. But in this case, it was public host name of the load balancer. But an organization can put a special DNS record in place, I believe, to prevent Acme TLS certs from working on that. And Amazon has that for Amazon AWS. So you can't even use Let's Encrypt certificates on that. So I think the TLS problem is not an easy one to solve.
Is the TLS thing, I missed one port, is this for like customer access into an application that's being like third party customers, like access into the, into an application that's being hosted on that EKS cluster? Or is that purely for you as the SaaS provider to get into the, the cluster?
Yeah. So I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. So our product will be deployed in a totally private environment, right? Again, no outbound or inbound access. The expectation is a customer, you know, once we stand up the product or they run our CloudFormation template, everything gets deployed. They'll, you know, let's say they have an internal hosted zone, a private hosted zone. They'll create something like, you know, product.customer.internal DNS record and point it to the ALB that gets deployed as part of the Kubernetes cluster. And that's, you know, and this is purely internal, you know, however they have their hosted zones set up and everything, we're thinking we shouldn't really care. We deploy the product, they create a DNS record and point it at it, and you know, other consumers internally can get to it. And yeah, I see the screen with replicated.
And the ingress like into your product, is that like using like AWS ingress controller and sending up an ALB, or do you have Nginx, or like what do you have? How does it get in there?
Oh, I don't remember the exact specifics, because the developers are slowly making some changes to how that works, but our recommendation was, let us use the ALB controller chart that gets deployed as part of EKS. I think because AWS now natively supports it. And then that's how we expose the endpoint for the product, via the application load balancer record.
No, I was just gonna say, like, if the customer has to configure DNS to like to direct their own internal users to this thing, like, it's reasonable for them to also configure an ACM certificate that covers whatever that is, and then you just need a way for them to be able to specify it, so that gets added to the annotation on the load balancer controller when you spin up like the name that they're going to, you know, use it as. So that should be easy enough.
Yeah. But it's the, so that part, yeah. Our recommendation to the customer was, hey, use ACM. I don't know, I haven't used private ACM, so I'm not sure if that fits the bill here or not. I need to maybe do a little bit more of a read through, but generate a certificate using ACM. Just tell us what that is in the CloudFormation template as part of a parameter input, and then we'll go attach that to the load balancer. But the question I think our team is having is, how do we deal with the certificates from mutual TLS, like between services, the pods?
And what was your, because you said you were on the call a couple weeks ago when we talked about that, and what was the problem with that solution, just using self-signed certs with Cert Manager inside of the cluster itself?
Aside from it being just a liability, right, I mean, it could just be some dummy in self-signed certs. I think
the liability I was talking about was introducing a service mesh. I was saying that the mitigation for that is, and the easiest thing is just using self-signed certs and enabling TLS on the on the pods themselves.
I think one of our, maybe this is something we need to push back internally with our product owner. What was their exact words? They said it wouldn't look good. I didn't have a lot to say then because it was already a long meeting, but we were trying to see if it was even possible to use Cert Manager, with whatever ACM the customer provides.
Cert Manager doesn't work with ACM. Cert Manager will work with any Acme.
Right.
It'll work with maybe some cloud, but ACM, I think it might work with private CA technically, but that's $400 a pop. For each account that you deploy that in. So customers might not like that.
Yeah.
You could also deploy a CA on your, an actual like certificate authority on the Kube cluster. And then that certificate authority can issue certificates for the various pods and use those for mutual TLS.
Okay. Is there anywhere I can read a little bit more about that? Is there somewhere specific?
So when you look at the Cert Manager documentation, there's like a resource for an issuer. I believe that's for the CA, no?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. So I can definitely...
It's a first-class concept in the implementation.
Yeah, it's here it is right here. This is the... I pasted it in the Zoom chat for you.
Got it.
And I think I was probably loose in my terminology. I was saying self-signed, but I don't think that's... I didn't actually mean self-signed in that sense. It's a certificate signed by the cluster issuer. So it is more or less akin to how the mesh would work, except for the mesh can ensure that only certain certificates are accepting connections from certain clients.
But you can also using this, like the issuer, you can also I think you can tie it into other like things. I think like Let's Encrypt and a couple other things. Like you can actually get it to use a third party CA that's trusted by browsers and that kind of thing if you needed to. But if it's purely for in cluster communications, it can just be its own its own fully functional CA.
Okay, yeah. Awesome.
For Acme, it has to be publicly accessible so the challenge works.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'll try to dig up some more info on possibly using this with private ACM. But like you said, if the cost is an issue, which likely it might be, I gotta look into that a little bit more. But to this replicated product, this is actually something we're already doing some
POCs on. Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, okay. Because we want to do a couple things in parallel. The only thing with replicated is, in AWS, we're using EKS, obviously managed control plane, versus replicated, which I believe from the documentation and some of the resources that they have available, this is effectively like TOPS, I believe. They set up a standalone Kubernetes cluster, but that opens us to, hey, there's vulnerabilities now, and there's all these other things that we have to, administer and manage. And we're trying to do this with no access to the customer environment. Yeah. So we just want to give them, a self-deployable, seamless solution.
I agree that but your concern there, I thought that was like one of the main selling points of replicated is they take on that burden. But if they're not taking on that burden, then diminishing return on using it. I like the idea that this kind of helps you have shrink-wrapped, self-hosted software, but don't have personal experience.
Yeah. The nice thing about this is, like, if, since we're responsible for deploying the actual Kubernetes cluster, that might change later on. We have some weird roadmap happening while we speak. If a customer provides us the network and a Kubernetes cluster, regardless of where, this might fit the bill because, again, it packages everything up nicely and, doesn't matter what Kubernetes cluster gives you the capability to deploy it there. They have like air gap solutions. So like if a customer, won't allow ingress from third party providers, they kind of bundle everything together in like a GUI installer. And if you have a descriptive Kubernetes cluster you want to also deploy as part of that installer, it lets a user or an engineer unpack everything and then install it. Anything we find out from our POCs there, I'll be happy to share.
Yeah, the other thing worth investigating if you go down the private CA thing is what the heck do they call it? It's called like there's two modes of the private CA. One is like the general mode, and the other one is like short-term certificates or something like that. And basically, I think it's only like $50 a month if you use that one, and you can issue a certificate that has a validity of up to 7 days. So as long as you can reissue your certificates within a 7-day period, you can actually pay significantly less for the CA in that case, like the private CA. It's like $50 versus $400 or something like that.
Oh, really?
The 400 will give you like certificates that have any validity length that you decide to specify, but the short lived ones or whatever it's called is like I think up to 7 days, and it's I think I'm right, it's like 50 versus 400, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, generally the certificate piece of it, we thought, hey, maybe the customer should just provide an input of what they want to use and we'll, try to accommodate it. Because it's kind of hard before a customer installs our like standalone SaaS solution, like for us to be able to predict what, sort of
Oh,
things meet their compliance and
yeah.
all sorts of
I
other
was
things.
talking purely for your in-cluster communications. You could use this.
Okay, gotcha.
And
And then
CertiMed
you.
supports this too, right? It supports the CCA, right? Oh, cool.
Geez,
And then
400 a month.
that was
Yeah,
for
then I
the
think
long.
that's for the general purpose ones. But as long as you can reissue your certificates at least every 7 days, since you control both ends of the plane, you should be able to do that. You should be able to use this $50 one, and then it's something cheap. It's like under 10 cents a certificate for every certificate that you issue from there after that, I think. Yeah, there you go. 5.5 cents, 5.8 cents, whatever.
Oh, cool.
So they're not going to kill you on that.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. I really appreciate you guys answering my questions.
Yeah, our
Thank
pleasure.
you.
Any other questions we can get answered today? We got
My
about.
biggest question is, why doesn't everyone appear around the conference table? And some people are on the conference table and some people are above.
Yeah, that's true. Well.
Mini mysteries of Zoom.
And then, like Nena, she has her avatar there, but no one else is.
And I keep looking up and down. I have to keep looking up and down to look between the people that are somewhere at the conference table and somewhere up above.
That's
Am
because I
I?
have my camera off.
Yeah, but
Okay,
you're the
maybe
only one
someone
who actually
shared.
has an avatar. Like everyone else just has a
That's a
name.
name.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Maybe that's
I
just the
don't know.
org
Did
login.
you guys accept it? Like when the notification came on? I don't know. I pressed the button, said got it or something.
And Matt,
Think
I
so.
don't see your headshot on the in class. All right, is your camera off as well or?
No, I'm up above.
Weird.
I think it
Huh.
might be
There's like
from
a
when
strip
you
with a
shared
bunch
it.
of us.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. On my side, I only see myself here, and then everyone else, like Andy, Brian, Venkat, Michael, Robert. No video. Mine is the only video I see on my side.
Oh, Interesting.
Interesting.
They have a raise hand button. They should have a maybe a sit down button too.
I guess all the rest of us are standing.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Can you guys see that? No.
Whoa.
It's moving.
Yeah. Do
Why
you
is my
see
name floating?
it? Yeah. All right, Minka, you
Eric
want
just
to
suplexed
answer?
you. Oh, there he is.
Now I see you.
What do you have to? You have to bring everyone there somehow? I don't know.
Oh, is that the
That's
issue?
weird.
I wonder if it's just
Maybe.
because when you started the share and nobody else was here, maybe, so it didn't put him in there.
Oh, that could be. Let me see what
Don't know.
happens if I stop sharing.
No.
I see Matt.
No.
Yeah, interesting. I think that might be something. So if I say leave immersive view and then start immersive. Thanks everyone for helping me dog food this or test it. All
There we
right.
go. Oh yeah,
Oh,
there we are.
it's a little
Oh, I
bit
get to
tricky.
sit
All
next to
right.
you, Eric.
Yeah.
I
I feel
know.
like I had to sit back a certain distance or something, otherwise my shoulders are too big for the back of the chair.
Hey, there's like a wall. I can't reach out and touch the person next to me.
Ah.
It's
One question
all
for
right.
Eric. Is the fireflies.ai, is that the AI summary tool from Zoom? Or is that a
Yeah,
different?
but it's not mine. I think it's just there's somebody who has joined our session that has invited their Firefly note taker to every one of these. So they are.
Got it. I haven't used the AI feature from Zoom, so I was wondering if they're just partnered with Fireflies or if that was
No, they have their own thing.
This is some guy, Michael, who has sent
Okay.
note taker.
It's like being in college. You pay someone to take notes for you and you don't go to class.
Yeah, exactly.
You just read all the notes.
I have another question. Has anybody used the Slack Canvas feature? I was looking at that again today, and I was curious if there's been any gotchas or if folks have been able to use it for, say, onboarding people, anything else like that.
I haven't dug into it myself. Is it a whiteboard or is it?
That's the weird part, is that it looks like a whiteboard, but when I went to use the template on it, it was like, here's how you would generate a canvas for onboarding somebody to a team, and it would show all these useful links and like, on here's where you go for this chat, and here's this person that you notify for this, and so it looked more like as if it was a tool for collecting notes about the channel as a way to summarize the channel, maybe.
It's kind of like a shared Google Doc.
Yeah, you
can. Yeah, it's also shared.
You can create new canvases and all that. I'm using it. It works fine. Keep in mind that multiple people can edit it. So if somebody accidentally deletes content or does an erroneous paste or stuff like that, there might be issues. But it's been working fine. Discovery is not super trivial. But instead of sharing notes in like text snippet or stuff like that, you can put it in a canvas and it looks better.
Right. And then maybe even have like a auto like notifier from the Slack bot. So if somebody asks one of the canned questions for this canvas, it just replies with the link to the canvas or something like that.
Boy, Vlad, how did you get this? This was created 15 minutes ago and you already announced it.
I was checking my email while y'all were talking about mutual TLS. I don't care about mutual TLS.
Cool.
I suddenly got like, I don't know, we were 20 emails from GitHub or something like that. This one was the only one relevant for this meeting.
Yeah, this is desperately needed in GitHub Action, so that's cool. But did they put it where on the? They didn't assign it to a quarter yet. Cool. Well, we are basically at time here, so unless there's any other quick questions, I guess I'll wrap things up. All right.
I just had one other quick thought just on the you can leave now, Vlad, if you want, because you're going to be bored by this, but I have another thought on the quick mutual TLS thing. One of the things you could do is if they're subscribing to your software for some period of time, like if it's not a perpetual license, you could actually sign the certificates like with your own CA, and make them valid for just the period of time plus a little buffer that they've subscribed to. And then when you actually ship your software, then it will use your certificates, and you can shift the certification chain with that and just install it in the boxes that they run on. So just another thought.
That's kind of cool. Matt, so you can share a ACM certificate across accounts?
You have to export the key, but you can if you do that, yeah.
Oh, exporting the key. So the resource itself, you couldn't just share it with their org?
No, but I'm saying you could share the public key.
That's
right. And yeah, and then you basically, like, it can verify that it's been signed by that and it's still valid, like up to a period of time. I guess the only problem was you need a way to do cert revocations if you needed to do that somehow. But if it's contained within itself, you know, one Kubernetes cluster, it might not be that big of an issue.
I've also had the conversation that you mentioned that this is one external customer. And it's okay to do stuff manually and work with them. But if you're going to keep having external customers, you do want to implement a proper SaaS control plane that creates tenants and automates all this and handles it. Because after a point, doing stuff manually and sending emails back and forth will become very, very unwieldy.
Yeah, although I will